It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. This morning, we remember a bit about Appalachia as experienced by Bobby Kennedy.
The 60s really happened in a big way in Appalachia, and I think a lot of people don't realize that, people outside the region.
This is West Virginia Morning. Several bills this legislative session deal with criminal justice reform, specifically bills to help reduce the number of people incarcerated in West Virginia and to remove housing and employment barriers for people who live in the jail system, who leave the jail system, rather. On last night's episode of the Legislature Today, Emily Allen spoke with Jeff Sandy, Secretary of the West Virginia Department of Military Affairs and Public Safety, for an overview of reform efforts in his agency. Here's an excerpt from the interview taped live at the Capitol.
I think I do want to start with, for people or viewers that might not be familiar with your department, and specifically the department or the Division of Corrections and Rehabilitation in your department, what are some of the rehabilitation efforts and things going on right now to prepare people in incarceration for what happens next after they get out?
Currently, we have over 250 type avenues for inmates to achieve their goals when they leave our system. They can get an associate's degree, they can get a bachelor's degree in all kinds of different trades, from woodworking, plumbing, welding, etc. So 250 items are available.
Sure, and I know substance use disorder is a prominent problem in our state. Obviously, we talk about it all the time in our facilities. We've heard some about the GOALS program, but can you kind of go on to what that is and what it does?
Right. In 2017, we needed to come up with a plan to address individuals who were not a violent offender that had drug problems. But in addition, to go deeper, that drug courts was not working for them. They needed an environment where it was structured. So we started the GOALS program. And the GOALS program started at Western Regional Jail, and now we have it
And that's in Cabell County?
Yes. Okay. In Putnam County, I'm sorry.
Putnam County, okay.
And now we have one in Moundsville. And our goal is to have them all over the state. And what that program is, it's a structured. We address the inmate, their health, their diet, and the way they think about things mentally. Peer pressure is one of the key items that we work on, because these individuals, they go out, they're free, they're working, and someone comes, "I'll just try it." And we tell them that this is not the avenue to take. So the program, their defense attorney, the prosecutor, and the judge, all three have to agree for them to enter the program. The program is a minimum of 6 to 9 months, and they are trained on how not to get involved in drugs again. After the 6 to 9 months, they go back to the sentencing judge, and he can reduce their incarceration from 2 to 15, 3 to 15, or even more to the time served. To date, it has saved West Virginia counties over $1 million in their regional jail bill.
That's interesting. And I mean, speaking of the cost to counties and the cost to the state, during all these judiciary meetings we've had in the legislature this year, one big reason for criminal justice reform has been overcrowding. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because overcrowding isn't just a problem of too many people in a facility, it's expensive to the counties and expensive to you guys. So you wanted to mention that's something that we've been hearing a lot of, and that's kind of what's prompted this legislation to get more people out. The legislature is starting to kind of reconsider, you know, who needs to be in there and for what lengths of time. In our package, we had mentioned House Bill 4004 that is supposed to go to the Senate Judiciary Committee. There's talk about it coming up tomorrow. House Bill 2419 dealing with bail reform is going to be on the Senate Judiciary Committee tomorrow. I want to take a step back and ask about some parole reform efforts. Mm-hmm. There was a Senate bill that has gone to the governor's desk. I think actually he signed it, or he's about to, relating to parole, and it's something that your department would enforce. Can you talk a little bit about what parole is like now and what changes that would impose?
Absolutely. Today, we have over 2,800 inmates who are eligible for parole in the next 18 months. The parole board is 9 individuals. And as you can tell from the math, it would be almost impossible for them to hear all these parole hearings. So presumptive parole has been developed. And what that does is, if an individual meets various requirements, and it's important to note, it is a non-violent offender. Mm-hmm. This if you're a violent offender, you're a rapist, a child molester, a murderer, et cetera, this is not for them. But these non-violent offenders, if they meet certain requirements, they are eligible for parole, and they do not have to appear in front of the parole board.
And I do want to ask off of that, because there has been a bit of a concern. We're talking about getting these people out of these facilities, but not really about what waits for them afterwards. So you did talk at the beginning about some of the rehabilitation efforts ongoing in the facilities. But what kind of system or infrastructure is in place or will be in place for people who meet the requirements and are entered on presumptive parole?
Well, the key is this. An individual 4 years ago that was released in the time of need, we call it the trigger effect. And that trigger effect is, they could be in line just trying to get their driver's license. They stress out and they reach out and they want that drug. We have life coaches for them. We have way
outside the facility.
Outside the facility. The parole people that come out to visit with them, rather than, they encourage them to succeed. And we had an individual recently who has been paroled, and he got a job at $65,000 a year working in trade. So it's, we are doing everything we can to make people successful when they are released from us.
That was Jeff Sandy, Secretary of the West Virginia Department of Military Affairs and Public Safety, speaking with Emily Allen on the legislature today. Visit our website, wvpublic.org, to hear the full interview. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:51. Becoming mostly sunny today and breezy, there's a chance of rain in the afternoon, highs in the 50s and low 60s. Partly cloudy tonight with lows in the 30s. Mostly sunny tomorrow with highs in the 50s. Partly cloudy tomorrow night. Slight chance of rain or snow with lows in the 30s. Chance of rain or snow Friday with highs in the 30s and 40s. Support for the weather forecast is provided by Jaeger Airport CRW, now with flights to Orlando, Florida MCO. More at JaegerAirport.com. In February 1968, Robert Kennedy, then a U.S. senator, took a trip to eastern Kentucky to investigate the successes and the failures of the war on poverty. In the new book, All This Marvelous Potential, author Matthew Algio examines the trip and digs into what Kennedy saw, what has changed since then, and what remains the same.
Going back and researching this book, I found out some incredible things were happening in Appalachia. Protests against strip mining, protests against the school systems and education there, even protests against the Vietnam War. And this was among people who supported the war by quite a margin, but they saw their own sons on the front lines of this war. And so that led them to question it. So I guess the biggest surprise is, yeah, that like the 60s really happened in a big way in Appalachia. And I think a lot of people don't realize that, people outside the region, what a tumultuous time it was even there.
Tell me a little bit about discovering when you learned that there was a recording of the speech at Alice Lloyd.
Yeah. As a radio guy, it still puts a smile on my face. But I was interviewing Reverend Lawrence Baldridge. He's the minister at a Baptist church in Pippa Passes, Kentucky, and that's where Alice Lloyd College is. And I asked him if there was any chance that there was a copy and anybody recorded the speech. He said, oh, yeah, Benny Lee Moore, he's got a copy.
We're talking in the car, there's great wealth here, the great possibilities in eastern Kentucky. But there has to be people who are going out and fight for eastern Kentucky. That's what really is desperately needed.
He had needed to borrow the school's reel-to-reel tape recorder, and this was several weeks, even maybe a month or two after the speech, and then he went to get the tape recorder, and there was a tape already on there, and fortunately, he went to listen to it, and here it was the Kennedy speech. Somebody had recorded the speech and then just left the tape on the reel-to-reel, so he took it home, and that's where it is today.
I thought it was interesting in your production of the book or writing the book that you jumped back in time. It wasn't just kind of a travelogue of 1968 or and literally 2 days on the ground in eastern Kentucky. But you did drop back and pick up a lot of that history to put Kennedy's visit in context.
Yeah.
You know, drop back to the 20s and the mine wars and Bloody Harlan and all that as well.
Well, it was funny. I talked to Steve Kaywood. He's another guy I met. Fascinating, and just one of the sweetest guys in the world. And he was a University of Kentucky law student who happened to know Carl Perkins, who was the congressman from eastern Kentucky at the time, and somehow finagled his way into Kennedy's car for this trip. And so he sat in the car with Kennedy riding up front in a state trooper drove, and he and Carl Perkins in the back. I mean, it's just incredible. Talk about, you know, having a, you know, not a front seat, but a back seat to history. But anyway, I was asking him about, you know, Bloody Harlan, and he lives in Pineville, and his family had been there a long time. And you know, it was his great uncle was one of the people who was murdered in the violence, in the conflict that accompanied the strikes in Harlan. And another one of his, I think it was his grandfather, was one of the judges. And then it's a direct line, really, from what happened in the 20s to the 60s to Kennedy's trip.
How would life have been different if Bobby hadn't been assassinated?
Yeah. You know, of course, I asked everybody who I talked to that, and everybody has a slightly different answer. I mean, I really think poor people believed in Kennedy, and I think Kennedy had a way of, you know, Kennedy's background, he was attorney general, and he was fighting Hoffa in the 50s, a big, you know, trying to basically take on the Teamsters Union. So on the one hand, he did have a reputation for being kind of a tough SOB and for fighting crime. But at the same time, he clearly had this innate compassion for the dispossessed and for the poor. And I think he, in American politics, had the ability to sort of combine those two qualities into real political realities, that he could have gotten things done.
The title of the book, All This Marvelous Potential, is that referring to Bobby Kennedy? Is that referring to...
That is, that is a line actually from Kennedy's speech at Alice Lloyd College, and really just stuck out to me as you know, his view of the situation in eastern Kentucky at that time. And you know, I think a lot of people would say, you could say the same thing even today.
But also in every walk of life, the people that are going to get up and stand on their feet and fight for eastern Kentucky, that's what is needed.
That was U.S. Senator Robert Kennedy speaking to a group of students and faculty at Alice Lloyd College in eastern Kentucky in 1968. Matt Algio, the author of All This Marvelous Potential, Robert Kennedy's 1968 tour of Appalachia, says he uses small stories to try to tell bigger stories in American history. This is his sixth book. This interview is part of an occasional series with authors from Appalachia or writing about the region. You can find more author interviews at wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our news director and producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.